about on the prophets of Israel. And as promised, I want to divide this last lecture to two parts. The first one will be not only a summary of some of the key ideas that we talked about, but also it is a summary that wants to put things in perspective and kind of tie in any kind of loose ends that you might have had in your minds. And the second part will be a PowerPoint presentation, so I apologize to those who are listening to this. Ah, okay. Where we deal with the idea of divine illumination as it appears in art, especially religious art. You'll see that most of it is actually Christian, because Jewish art tends to avoid these kinds of issues. It deals with other things. So let us start with the first part, and that is, I would like to throw at you a statement that is well known in Judaism from its early rabbinic period. And that statement is that since the destruction of the temple, or the temples, prophecy has ceased to exist in Israel. In other words, in other places the rabbis say that since the Churban, prophecy was given to children and to fools. What do you make of this statement by the rabbis? Let's start with whatever comes to your mind, and then we'll unpack it. Okay, so you are saying there is some sort of an underpinning, kind of a political maneuver here that aims to substantiate rabbinic authority in a community that is in need of leadership. That is absolutely correct, but it's not the entire picture, but it's absolutely a component there. There is a rabbinic agenda at play. What else? Yeah, but that's the result of what I just said. I'm asking, what is the reason for what I just said? You're right, but that's already the outcome. What do you think? Here was one practical answer. Okay, it's a power play. What else? Try to put it in the context that we've studied together. I'll give you a clue. We talked about the Axis Mundi. We talked about the theological structure of the biblical era, of the Second Temple era, before the rabbinic period. What happens there? You remember? Remember when we discussed the destruction of almost each and every element of Axis Mundi in the theological construction? You remember, we talked about the temple, we talked about the Kohanim, we talked about the monarchy, we talked about the land of Israel. You remember, we talked about all of these things being destroyed, and alongside comes a new power that needs now to vindicate its authority, and indeed finds that there's one more PowerPoint that needs to be put aside in order to substantiate the centrality of Torah. Thus, the rabbis now take the concept of a prophet and also marginalize it in order to create a new theological construction, which will become the rabbinic construction. You remember we discussed this at length when I tried to show you the difference between the rabbinic model of Torah study from bottom up and the Christian model of bringing God to earth from above down. You remember all of this? So the cessation of prophecy becomes an imperative tool for the rabbis in order to substantiate or to introduce a new religious and theological agenda. And that is that the only route to God's mind, as it were, the only way to figure out the truth, from personal to cosmic truth, is through the only element that remains untouched or unscathed by the incredible destruction of the Second Temple, and that is Torah. Torah is left. Nobody can destroy the Torah. You can burn the parchment, but you cannot destroy the Torah. And therefore, Torah study becomes the zeitgeist. It becomes the way of the land, from the bottom up. You do, you unpack the four layers of Torah study, blah, blah, blah. Eventually you enter the orchard. Eventually you get into the mind of the esoteric, the secret, the magical, if you want, lure of what Torah has to offer. Well, it's a very, very good point, and I think that one of the ways to look at it is that was the Kohanim's familiar landscape for the temple was not there. And since their authority stemmed from their daily rituals at the temple itself, physically sacrificial offerings, physically bringing the bulls and bringing the pigeons and bringing... There was nothing there. It was, and they were part of the people that were dispersed all over the known land at the time. It was very hard to reestablish this kind of authority. First of all, Kohanim were dispersed alongside the other people. Second, the introduction or reintroduction of synagogues in their rabbinic mode did not require that anymore. And rabbis changed the sacrificial offering into a sacrificial of the tongue, a sacrifice of the lips, Neshalma Parim Sfateinu, as it says in the book of Yoel. And the Kohanim lost their raison d'etre in that regard. They remained as part of the Aliyot, Kohanim, Levim, and Israel, but no more than that. The prophets were much more dangerous. And we're starting with the most essential prophet in that light, and that is Yeshua, who came not only as a prophet, but also came as the Son of God, the Son of Man, and was literally... evolving to become a major, major threat in that regard. So in the first century CE, we find the evolution, the beginning of the disparity, the beginning of the distance between what will be called rabbinic Judaism and early Christianity. Two theological models, the sanctification of the prophetic voice in early Christianity and the marginalizing of the prophetic voice in rabbinic Judaism. Yes, but we'll see that in Judaism the prophetic voice never actually ceased. It just assumed different terminologies and different attires and different disguises. We'll see. That's where I want to take us today, because what the rabbis said was first and foremost, it wasn't a theological statement. It was first and foremost, just like you said, it's an act of self-preservation and vindication. And I'm not saying it was not a malicious intent. It was really a vision that saw that in the reality that those rabbis perceived, there was simply no room for a prophet. There was a need, a profound need for a new form of leadership for a nation that was dispersed, was broken, was shattered, and was in need of a very, very different theological structure in order to maintain its fragile integrity. The problem is, of course, on a number of levels. And the challenge here is on a number of levels. Challenge number one, one could claim, and I'm making a very, very bold claim, that the picture that I was trying to paint for you about what prophets were had actually no threat for the rabbinic authority. Because prophets were, as I tried to show you for 4 weeks, they were not soothsayers. They were not fortune tellers. They were ethical beacons that had a finger on a nation's pulse, as the title of this lecture is, and try to show the optimal path toward an optimal alignment with divinity. In other words, I would like to suggest that when the rabbis say prophecy has ceased from Israel, they actually meant it in a very, very myopic way. Prophets meaning fortune tellers, those who know what the future is going to bring, those who can tell you what will happen to you. A perception that on many other fronts is actually, it runs contrary to the rabbinic perception of human authority on this earth. And I want to make clear what I mean here. The same rabbis that would say that prophecy has ceased from Israel, in other places, do not perceive future telling or fortune telling as a viable option at all. They perceive the human conduct as the one that creates the future. In other words, you're in the present. What you do in the present will determine your fate. It is the same rabbis that I mentioned, the same rabbis in the Mishnah or in the Pirkei Avot that come and says, on the one hand, Rabbi Chanina says, "En adam nokef etzba milemata eli imken machrizim alav milemala." A person cannot lift a finger below unless it was so decreed from above, which seems to be ultimate determinism. In other words, God knows everything previous to the action itself, which raises a profound question about free will and what is the autonomy of. The same Rabbi Chanina says, "Akol beidei shamayim, milvad irat shamayim." The same rabbi now says, everything is in the hands of heaven, with one exception, which is a profound exception. The belief in heaven is at the hands of man. So, in other words, if the human, him or herself, does not accept divine authority, the author, as it were, the divine cannot actually manifest itself in human actions. It is the domain of the human to determine the effectiveness of God. This is a remarkable statement. And you can see this early as the Talmud, in one of the most famous and most revolutionary stories of Achnai's oven, which I believe we've studied here, at least touched, and many, many others, by the way. In other words, the notion of dialogue between sages, dialogue between people, the clash of the minds, which produces relevant truth for the generation. And I said it to you before, the rabbis are much more interested in applicable truth rather than absolute truth.
I think one of the things that may have worried the rabbis, and still does to this day, is that after all is said and done, there is some element of the, not to say mystical, certainly mystical, but the irrational in the prophetic narratives, especially in Ezekiel.
In all of them, you can say that.
Well, there's a lot going on there. And of course, for the rabbinic mind, the most important thing was the disciplined, rational.
Be careful what you're saying. Now you're a tad generalizing here. I will definitely agree with you when you say the discipline. I will definitely agree with you when you say the hierarchical. I will definitely agree with you when you say the structured. I will definitely agree with you when you say the one that is built on a scholarly investigation of knowledge and the dialectic pole of dialogue. That rational is not necessarily the word of the game. Definitely, it's certain parts of Jewish rabbinical evolution. Even the term rational does not appear until the later medieval period. So we have to be a bit careful about that.
Yeah, but I mean, it begins early with the Arbish and the Kisulapardis. I mean, they're very worried about the mystical experience, and in our own time, I mean, the Hasidim. Mm-hmm. Not good. It's a perfect example. I mean, we're very suspicious about the people who try to fall into ecstatic chants. And go, oh, I mean, this is very anti-rabbinic.
Okay, again, I definitely can agree with what you're saying on the largest level, because the dichotomy that you're creating here between those who were in favor of the rational path and those who, let's put it differently, and we'll have a concrete example today, from those who believed that that the human intellect, let's put it this way, that the human intellect is not the only epistemological venue en route to God. Did you follow what I just... Any attempt to create a clear dichotomy between those who celebrated the human intellect and the rational path, and those who believe that the human intellect and the rational path are only one epistemological element in the human condition, this dichotomy is not that clear. And by the way, even today there are those scholars who try to show that, let's take a quintessential rational thinker like Maimonides, who had a profound appreciation of other epistemological venues in the human condition, intuitive knowledge. Maimonides himself speaks about truths that appear on a prophetic level. He calls them kemar'e ha-bazak. And he's referring, by the way, interestingly enough, to Ezekiel. He says, it is a flash of brilliance. You get a glimpse of it and it eludes you. It escapes you. In other words, you cannot, there are certain levels of truth that cannot be wrapped around by the human intellect alone. Now, without delving into, because that's a whole, you're opening a whole lecture here and a whole debate, which is most fascinating. We also have to remember that there are certain venues of knowledge. Those who do not accept the intellect as the only venue of knowledge will come and say, there are certain venues of knowledge which not only defy the intellect, but also defy the properties of intellectual investigation, such as language, such as formulation, such as putting it in coherent rubrics and articulating it. They will come and say, there are certain levels of knowledge where you just know something, but then when people ask you, how do you know, you're incapable of articulating it because they defy those human properties that rely so heavily on analysis, intellectualization, and so on and so forth. For example, you gave the example of the Mitnagdim and the Hasidim. So we all know, of course, the famous story with Rabbi Shneur Zalman of Ladi, the Baal Tanya, who went to the Vilna Gaon and was not accepted in his courtyard and was... Which brings us exactly to the second point that I want to make. If we accept the human condition from a theomorphic vantage point, that is, that the human soul is part of God above, and you remember, we discussed this, and that the human soul is created with potentially, right? In potential, it has the tools, it has the ability to fathom the divine will, to unite with divinity. You remember that was one of the major elements that we discussed for 4 weeks now, that the dichotomy between God and man is much, much, much more blurry than we initially thought. If we accept the theomorphic, if we accept the theomorphic model, we can definitely raise the question, if the human is by definition created in the image of God, why can't there be a prophet among us today? Why can you not be a prophet? Why cannot you be a prophet? In other words, the prophecy now is not a question of inherent condition, rather than a question of what rabbis also call mi'ut hadorot, lessening of the generations. The lessening of the generations. We are dwarfs who are sitting or standing on the shoulders of giants, which I always found an amusing image, because a dwarf who's standing on the shoulder of giant is still higher, taller than the giant. But we won't go there. Yeah, right? What's the highest point on earth? It is the tallest man or woman who ever climbed the Everest. It's not the Everest. Right? So when we look at the theomorphic model, there is no reason, and here I use the word reason deliberately, to assume that prophecy has ceased. Not just from Israel, but from the human condition. Third point. If we discuss God the way we discussed God, and it was very, very important for me to kind of hammer in time and again, that God is not a religious idea, but rather a moral necessity. In other words, that God, the existence of God, does not necessitate a particular religion. It does necessitate a particular theological construction that is basically ethical. We discussed all of this, if you remember. And we said, and I gave you examples, historical examples. One of the most brilliant ones is the Declaration of Independence of the American 13 colonies, where what they do there, those men that in my book are prophets, for what reason? Because they come and say, there are certain values that are inherent to the human condition, if we want to maintain them as inherent in the human condition, they cannot be the property of human agreement, but rather of divine endorsement. That's why we hold these truths to be self-evident. They are perpetuated from their inner truth, and not because you and I decided that they are true. It is only then that we can now come and say there are certain values in the human arena that are not subject to human discourse. In that respect, the Declaration of Independence, I'm not talking about the entire document, I'm talking about this assertion, all men are created equal, and here I'm talking men now as humans, because I think that that's exactly where it led eventually, because it had no choice. It had no choice. All men are created equal is not a human invention or a human agreement, but rather a human discovery of a divine truth. In other words, we now come and say that in 1776, we came to an evolution, we came to a point in our human evolution where we were finally able to articulate that which had always been true. What that document does, it comes and says, until this point, humans lived erroneously. They now come and say, this is not the decision of late 18th century scholars or intellectuals, but rather it is a document that speaks about the mind of God. My friends, the Declaration of Independence is primarily a theological document. It is a theological document. And I'm saying it for the record here, that anybody who understands the Declaration of Independence as the separation of God and state does not understand a thing about the Declaration of Independence. Because it's exactly the opposite. It is the presence of God that offers or allows human affairs to separate between church and state. Because that's already religion. It is a divine will that you'll have a free will to decide whether you want to abide by a certain religion or another religion or no religion at all. Not contradictory, on the contrary, complementary. So do not confuse the separation of church and state with the separation of God and state. Nothing in common. So here come people who come and say a very simple statement, which, by the way, and I told to you, runs conceptually parallel to the Ten Commandments, so-called Ten Commandments. And I mentioned that to you already. The first dictum in the Ten Commandments is not a commandment. It's a statement. Anochi Adonai Elohecha. If you don't accept this, if you don't accept the authority of this absolute author, don't bother reading. Don't bother reading further. Because what I'm telling you here is unnegotiable. It's not for you to discuss with me, do you agree with it, do you not agree with it, do you think it's nice for this generation, but perhaps not for the next generation. It is not spatio-temporal. It is eternal because it stems from the eternity of the author. Once we understand this, and we tie it in with the eternity of the theomorphic condition in the humans, we raise a profound question. Why would prophecy cease? Nothing has changed. The eternal is not subject to change. The political is. The religious is. The social is. What is allowed today was regarded profane 100 years ago, and usually the other way around. What we today take for granted as a moral convention was a revolution 100 years ago. Was unthought of 200 years ago. And we all live here, you know what I'm talking about. women's rights, children's rights, minorities' rights, human rights. We still have a long way to go. But anybody who looks at the world today, in many ways, we are starting to listen to the prophets. So since the prophet or the prophetic voice is eternal, because it abides by that eternal moral pulse, there is no reason to suggest that this capability is no longer our prerogative. So the question here I would like to argue is not whether a prophet ceased or not, because I don't think they ceased, not in potential. It's twofold. One, do we believe in ourselves as potential prophets? And I would argue that anybody who plays with that question seriously will very quickly, if you take my question seriously, you'll get a glimpse of the sheer terror that comes with that question. We're a peculiar bunch, humans. Each and every one of us, ultimately, in their most profound aspirations, wish they were God. And each and every one of us is afraid to take responsibility for 1 second of true creation. 1 second. We wish everybody could think like us. Wish everybody could believe like we do. Wish we could be on top of the mountain. We wish everybody could look at us and see the light. Somehow we are very, very good at neglecting the what happens next question. What is the profound responsibility that comes with the prophetic moment? I talked to you last week about that excruciating moment where the prophet understands, he or she understand, that to become a prophet, it is not enough to undergo a prophetic experience. It is to take that leap of incredible faith and courage and to move from the private domain to the public domain. To now stand in front of an audience who is bound to reject you and say with open eyes and with an open mouth, in this I believe. Knowing fully well that you are running against the stream. Some of you were not here last week. We talked about the difference between prophet and prophet. Prophets and profiteers. Knowing that what you are about to say is going to be faced with ridicule, with chastisement, that you are going to negotiate time and again between the desire to be honest, which is the charge of the prophetic call, and the human desire to be popular. Prophets are not popular. You are destined to be alone. You are destined to be alone. And don't be fooled by prophets who are celebrated post-mortem. Were celebrated after they had already, when all of a sudden humanity awakens and says, wow, I now get it. Good. So we have to ask ourselves, if we can become prophets, if we can become prophets, what does it actually mean? And I want to show you today that many Jews have asked themselves that question. For many, many reasons. Some of them, profiteers. Simply put, some of them for political gain. But others who truly believed that achieving prophecy will lead a nation towards a better future. Not a known one, Not a known one, but a better one. And one of the top thinkers on this issue was Maimonides. Anybody here knows what was prophecy for Maimonides? When Maimonides speaks about attaining the level of prophecy, that goes to what you said, my friend. What does he talk about? Anybody? Guess. From what you know from Maimonides, I argue you can guess, at least in broad strokes, what Maimonides would say about attaining a level of prophecy. Haschalim hanivdalim, the separated intellects. You know, I just gave you a... What do you think it would be? A process of rational intellectual refinement that is based on Torah study and deep thought in the sciences, in the philosophies, in art, in medicine, in a perpetual attempt to understand natural wisdom as corresponding and not in contrast to the divine wisdom, and the application of the human intellectual potential and its purification to the highest level that is accessible to mankind. Maimonides was a profound thinker, and he was truly a genius. But even Maimonides was humble enough to come and say, ultimately, and I'm saying it in different words, it is a Mount Sinai model. There is a limit to how high you can climb. Ultimately, God has to come down and meet you halfway. And if you purify yourself up to a certain point, God will meet you halfway. God will meet you halfway. The reason I'm giving you this example, my friend, is because Maimonides will be the so-called quintessential speaker of rational Judaism. But Maimonides speaks about prophecy. He just speaks about it in different terminologies. He now comes and creates an incredible kind of tapestry that on the one hand tries to agree or at least not ostensibly disagree with the classical rabbinic voice that says prophecy has ceased from Israel. But on the other hand, he comes and says, wait, prophecy is not just the product of a divine decision. In other words, God doesn't just scan the earth and eventually says, I want to talk to you. Why me? No reason. To you. Maimonides now comes and says, no. In order to reach that level, God searches for those who search for God. If you raise yourself to a point of intellectual refinement, and guys, remember the covenantal paradigm that we talked about. If you refine yourself, ultimately, you're opening already the door to the divine voice. It's not a cause and effect. The purification of the mind is in and of itself an invitation of the divine to enter.
But is he actually really saying going into Moses'
mission? I think that Maimonides meant it, that certain humans are capable of doing it. And if I may say so myself, I think that under the surface, Maimonides would never say it out loud, but I believe that Maimonides believed that he had attained it himself. Otherwise, it will be very difficult for him to speak about it from what he believes is actual an attainment of the divine. And Maimonides, in so many words, speaks about certain truth that can be attained, albeit they cannot be described. And I'll just then I'll let you. Maimonides says, for example, comprehension of him, may he be blessed, he's talking about God, encompasses our understanding that comprehending him is impossible. In other words, attaining the divine means that we now understand that attaining the divine is impossible. You understand that which you cannot understand. There's a very big difference between saying, I don't understand, and saying on the other hand, I now understand nothing. Okay? Yeah. Maimonides also had a huge problem with the idea of resurrection and Tchiyat HaMetim. He doesn't talk about it too much because Maimonides, after all, was a human being and he lived in his landscape. A lot of people. Don't think that Maimonides was born as Maimonides. It took almost two centuries until Maimonides had turned himself into such a major voice in the Jewish textual legacy. What Maimonides thought about himself, who am I to say? But if you read his writings and you read his discussions in Moreh Nevuchim and other places about prophecy and the attainment of prophecy, you see that Maimonides believed that if you can just you can close, but open the windows. Yeah, just open the windows. That achieving prophecy is achieving the highest level of truth on a cosmic level, which ultimately, again, ultimately leads to your purification on an ethical level. And Maimonides, just like many other prophets, is engaged with the study of Torah. And Maimonides was an elitist. Maimonides never thought that every human being can become a prophet, not because they didn't have the potential, but because life will take them on many other ways. They would not even give it the time of day. I mean, he's talking about a disciplined, rigorous application of the human mind. And Maimonides, like many other scholars, believed that different people had different capabilities of fulfilling that potential. But the most important thing for us to understand is that Maimonides did not negate the possibility of attaining a prophetic level at his day and age. That's what's important. He wouldn't say it in the rabbinic terminology because he doesn't want to go ahead against those classical rabbinic voices. But obviously, a lot of the Jewish thinkers speak in two tongues simultaneously. The one that is for the people and the one that you need to study further and contextualize in order to understand where they're coming from and what they think about themselves. And I'll show you another thinker today who completely believed he was a prophet. Completely believed he was a prophet. Yeah.
I'm just curious how to rationalize. I think 2 weeks ago we were talking about this idea of the human or the neutral reflection of God and this turning at the same time. And I'm now using that image and then this idea of going up a mountain and then once you get to the top, God will meet you halfway. But it seems like it's also...
That's what I mean. Just that. That's what I meant.
When is sort of that tipping point? What are the rabbis discussing in terms of, okay, maybe there aren't any living right now, but we're all somewhere on that spectrum, right? We're all in the process somewhere.
No, I absolutely understand what you're saying. It's just that for me, let's say that I'm not convinced by such an argument because it doesn't have... In my opinion, it does not allow me as a human being to aspire to reach my fullest potential. And my fullest potential, in my opinion, I'm talking only about myself now, is for no rabbi to decide. In other words, I come and say that the only sovereign to whom I pay allegiance is God. And God, not the God of religion, but the idea of God that I was talking about, which I believe is an inherent force. So I now come and say, okay, if those who come to me now and say that on the religious level I'm incapable, I choose not to accept that and to take my path in order to reach whatever I believe is a prophetic calling. For example, to come to serious terms with what I see and to juxtapose what I see with what I want to see in this world. And then ask myself the question, what do you do about it? To fight every day. How does Maran Yosef Karo from 16th century Tzfat, he writes in Shulchan Aruch, "Itgabar ka'ari la'asot avodat ha'boreh." every morning a man should rise like a lion to do God's calling. He says, why like a lion? Lamid gabar kari, because it's hard. It's hard. It's hard to listen to, it's hard to accept what you can be and to actually live a life like that. It's not supposed to be an easy path. That's why we can talk about the idea of prophecy until we're blue in the face. I think that reality will not change in that regard. Most people will choose, either willfully or just complacently, not to take that path. Because it's really much easier. I'm not even judging them. Because of that simple reason, most people don't understand what it means to be a prophet. What comes with that huge burden? It comes with a great responsibility not to take your life for granted, not to take other lives for granted, and to be in a state of awareness that is really excruciating. I mean, it's just difficult. Oblivion is a great bliss. Did prophets stop, or did we stop to listen? That's what I'm asking. Did prophets cease from the land, or did we no longer have a lens to identify them? Again, if you ask me about the modern period, we are already the result of a lens that does not look at prophets, again, from the conventional setup. If you ask me this question on the first session, I would say you most people, when they think about a prophet, they think about something that is completely different than what we've been talking about for 5 weeks. People, when you say, until today, go out, Seul Madis, the Talmud says. Go out and ask people, what is a prophet? I venture to say that 99.9%, if not 100%, will say something in the vicinity of a fortune teller, somebody who knows the future, somebody who tells that. And as I showed you, nothing to do with the truth of what a prophetic charge is. So a lot of people don't even look at the idea of prophecy with the right lens, even if they accept the notion of prophecy. That's number one. Second, the rabbis were very successful at not allowing this terminology to re-enter into the Jewish discourse. So who has the guts to come and say, I'm a prophet? They will be not only ridiculed, they will be shunned as heretics, because now there is a whole volume of bodies and authorities that come and say prophecy is impossible. It takes a lot of courage to challenge such a claim. And by the way, I have no doubt that those who may listen to this and will come and say that this guy is completely out of his mind.
But isn't that an imperative if you're a prophet?
Yeah.
You're not choosing not to be one.
So now comes the question, indeed, whether we're talking about a choice or about a compulsion. Is the prophet somebody who is obsessed or somebody who says something and can have some sort of an authority over what they say? And that's an incredible question. It is an incredible question. I will try to show you today, for example, that there are two sides to this. Most of the time people will come and say, because I purified myself, I am now a tsinor, I am a viaduct. I'm a conduit, exactly, thank you. I'm a vehicle to transmit the divine voice. What I'm telling you is not my words, but rather the divine words. And I'll show you how it manifests in art. Others will come and say, no, wait. There are prophets who come and say, I will talk for you. Allow me to do this for you. I want to take on this kind of a burden because I believe in what you have to say. So it's a complex question.
Where is there an example of that second in the Torah?
In the Tanakh. I think it's Jeremiah, who says, Vayomar Yirmiyahu Anochi, Hineni. I'll find it for you. Jeremiah. I'll find it here. Usually they're either reluctant or they're terrorized. And then we'll see. God feeds them the word. God gives them the word. God touches their lip. God purifies their heart. Whatever is happening there. But, and remember, the prophet is always, and we talked about this, a human being. In other words, the prophet is never presented as someone who has a potential that is higher inherently than any other human being. It will also be, allegedly, a rabbinic desire to elevate Moses to a point of almost untouchable, which is something that I personally, as a Jew, and I do not accept. The beauty of Moses is precisely by the fact that he's a human being. And that's the beauty of Judaism in that sense, from in my opinion. Are you asking me now personally?
Yeah.
I think Jesus was a prophet.
Yeah, exactly. And maybe one of the last.
Jesus was also a Jew.
Yeah.
He was a Jewish prophet. There's a difference between saying what was the person and how he was understood later on by others. These are two completely questions. But Jesus was a prophet, just like many others who came and said, this is what I see, this is where you should go. Now, you remember, those of you who weren't here, last week we talked about false prophets, and we saw that one of the main distinctions that the Torah makes between a true prophet and a false prophet, do you remember what that was? What is the lackmus paper? What is the lackmus test which distinguishes between a true prophet and a false prophet? Even if the false prophet can bring miracles to vindicate themselves and do all kinds of hokey pokey stuff, how do we know that there are false prophets? Do you remember what the Torah says about that?
They predict good things.
No, it has nothing to do with predictions.
Not predictions. They present a rosy picture.
No, not at all. Why? There are prophets. We have prophets who presented a rosy picture at the end. If you do that and that, then God will come back to you and you'll meet eye to eye and blah, blah, blah. And everybody goes to the sunset in Mount Moriah hand in hand. Beautiful. No. You remember, guys? If a prophet comes to you and he manages to turn snakes into that and fire into water and wind into that and a booming voice, blah, blah, blah. And then he comes and tells you something that counteracts and runs in contradiction to the divine decree, to the ethical charge, he's a false prophet. You remember we saw it last week. It tells you go and worship other gods. Go and abuse the orphan and the widow. Go and make money over the back of the poor. He's a false prophet. And God says, I will help him to do all those miracles in order to test you. And then listen to the message. Don't be fooled by the messenger. So if the Torah says listen to the message and don't be so obsessed by the messenger, I open my ears. I hear here and there prophetic messages in this world by a lot of people, irrespective of their religion. Because in my opinion, they abide by the same divine charge. They activate their potential. So we have to be at least attuned or attentive, not to be fooled by the scenery, but rather to be very, very attuned, as happened in Mount Sinai. Lir'ot et hakolot. To see the sounds, the voices. What are you saying to me? Not how do you look. God is saying in so many words, stay focused. It's very easy to distract you, you feeble-minded humans. Stay focused. Lo yelachem Elohim acherim al panai is a wonderful way of rendering it. You shall have no other gods but me. But in many words, in literally, lo yelachem Elohim acherim al panai, you shall have no other god but my face. Stay focused. Look at me. At me. Well, first of all, if you remember, one of the things that rendered Shabtai Tzvi and Natana Azati, who was one of his greatest advocates, as a false prophet. And again, the fact he called himself a prophet, not him, Natana Azati called him a prophet, was immediately shunned by other rabbis. How dare you call him a prophet? But then what Shabtai Tzvi did with Islam was rendered by them following other gods. Shabtai Tzvi, of course, understood it completely different. He can say you have to enter the lion's den in order to turn its skin around and eventually come out and have a whole following. And hundreds followed in his footsteps and converted into Islam. But what happened with Shabtaism, actually I will talk about it now, because Shabtai Tzvi is already at the height of this kind of a messianic fervor that engulfed major sections in Jewish life, an example of which I want to give you today, about people who truly believed that in so many ways they are reliving or entering a second era of reliving the biblical model, and wanted to kind of reinstate that kind of a biblical model and bring down the Shekhinah, converse with it directly, and ultimately attain a level of prophecy that will lead a nation to a complete redemptive catharsis. Prophetic. In my opinion, I'm talking only about my opinion. Prophetic. I have a dream. Prophetic. Isaiah Leibovich and what he said about 67 war. Prophetic. Prophetic in my sense.
Yeah.
It's nothing to do with God, nothing. Mother Teresa, prophetic. Rav Kook,
well,
or the ones who interpreted. So now we deal again with the difference between the prophetic call and its application by its disciples. Mm-hmm. We can enter Hasidism, show that in my opinion the way Hasidim treat their rabbis today is in complete contrast. I'll put it differently in this case. When we talked about Mount Sinai as one of the most, if not the most intimate rendezvous point between the divine and the human in the Jewish narrative, I want you to be very attentive to this concept of utmuna lo re'item zulati kol. You did not see any picture, but rather heard a voice. And I want you to stay focused on that voice. The beauty of monotheism in that sense is that it does not allow the human the pretext of idolatry. And idolatry I don't mean in the most superficial form. I'm talking about surrounding yourself with so many visual distractions that ultimately you fall into this paradox of the triumph of ritual over meaning. You're super engaged with a person. You're super engaged with a statue. You're super engaged with the celebration of worship. You're super engaged with the ritual, and you forget the message. In that respect, tmuna lo reitem zulatikol, you hear a voice, is in fact some sort of a meditation on a national scale. It comes and says to you, Shema Israel. Listen, hear. Don't look at me. I'm not here. I'm not there. You remember I gave you an excerpt from Rabbi Yehuda Levi. I'm further, rachok, rachok, nishme shamayim, v'karov, karov, miruchi u'bsari. I'm further away from any of your imaginations, and at the same time, I am you. ועשו לי מקדש ושכנתי בתוכם. Build me a sanctuary so I may dwell within you. Within you. Where are you looking for me? In so many words, there is this perpetual attempt to keep you focused on the ethical charge which is at the very heart of being human. Keep you focused. Keep you focused. There are so many distractions out there. People who are very charismatic. And people who are charismatic, and I told you that before in one of my lectures, can make you eat shit and believe you're eating chocolate. People who ultimately worship the figure rather than its message are idolaters. And that goes for certain segments in Judaism today. Today. Who rendered this guy a Messiah and this person a Messiah, the idolaters, I say it for the record. This is not the message. God is not hidden nor hiding. God is present. The question is, all the time, are you willing to hear? Are you willing to hear? Nothing has changed. In that respect, that goes to what I said to you in the second lecture. The covenantal paradigm is eternal. Its realization is contingent upon human behavior. Nothing has changed. That's why I believe there is absolutely no reason to negate the possibility of prophets today. The example I want to give you is from the writings of Rabbi Moses Cordovero, known as the Ramak. The acronym is Ramak. Rabbi Moses Cordovero lived in the 16th century in Tzfat, most probably one of the greatest Kabbalists who have ever lived, was also a man renowned for his attempts to reconcile between rational thought and Kabbalistic doctrines, was a prolific writer, lived between 1522 and 1570, most likely all of his life in Sfat, definitely since his late teens, and managed to produce, started studying Kabbalah by the way, at the age of 20, and at the age of 27 had already written his first book, known as Pardes Rimonim, which will become one of the most meaningful compendium of Kabbalistic terms and their explication. Lived until the early age of 48, died at 48, at the age of 48, after having written 7 books, one of which is 16 volumes long. The guy was a prolific writer, and among 1522, 1570. His burial site is still a major pilgrimage site in Tzfat, right adjacent to Isaac Luria's grave site. Isaac Luria was one of his disciples for 2 months before Ramak's untimely departure at Kavzayin Betamuz, 1570. Indeed, those who had read Ramak's works, many of them were baffled by not merely by the incredible wealth of knowledge and his ability to bring abstract concepts and articulate them in relatively clear terms, but they were fascinated by the volume of his writings. To write 7 works, one of which is 16 volumes long. And I had the privilege of reading some of the original manuscripts in archives in Dublin and in JTS and in Hebrew University. It's not just the leaf, it's in the corners and adding comments. And it's quite mind-boggling. And some of them ask themselves, they say, where did he get the time to write so much? And interestingly enough, it is truly, even for somebody like me who is much more rational and analytic and skeptical, when you read this guy, I mean, you question, you say, how did he find the time to write so profusely? And not just that, he had this ability to say, for example, to write a book and say, on this particular question, if God decrees so, I will write in a second book, in chapter number 3, subsection number 5. And 2 years later, you find it in section 3, subsection number 5, answering the question that he arose 3 years earlier. An interesting mind this guy had. But more interesting for us is how he perceived himself. How he perceived himself. And here I want to take you to, you're welcome to read those pages that I've given you. These are part of the book that I've written on the subject, but just let's look at page number 28 from the little package that you have there. And I've collected together from all of his writings an interesting term that he uses that is taken from the Bible. And he uses that term in a very, very, very interesting context. You can see at page 28, you can see a section in Hebrew and then the English. I will read in the Hebrew just so you can get the sound, and then we'll translate. By the way, every 3 lines, diagnostical lines between, it means that the verse is from a different book. You have the annotation there, okay? אבל מפני החוב המוטל עלינו, נפרש בה בחזקת היד. אחרי שכבר העתקנו דברי רבי מאיר ורבי דוד, והתעוררנו אליהם בחזקת היד. ראינו שלא להאריך בדקדוק לשון המאמר, אלא לפרש אותו בחזקת היד. רצוננו בפרק זה להעתיק דברי ספר הבהיר בשם זה ולבערו בחזקת היד. You get the picture, you get the sound. בחזקת היד is... Okay, let's translate. The duty before us necessitates that we explicate this verse by the mightily held hand. After having copied the words of Rabbi Moshe and Rabbi David, and after having been awakened to comprehend them by the mightily held hand, we realize that no lengthy exposition is needed, but an explication by the mightily held hand. Let's continue. We wish to copy the words of Sefer HaBahir on this term and explicate them by the mightily held hand. I have opted to scribe and explicate it here, but cannot do so in full since the main part is absent from the manuscript that he had in his possession. We shall nonetheless explicate it by the mightily held hand, so no part is absent from this piece, neither large nor small. Having sufficiently discussed those who stand aloof from this science, and after having dismissed, page 29, their opinions as afforded by God's good hand upon us, and lastly, all these matters were bestowed upon my mind by the hand of God. Bechizkat hayad. What do you think he means? What do you think he means? By the mightily held hand. Give me now a visual image of what you think God was controlling, was guiding him. In what kind of state we're talking about? You mentioned it before. Some sort of an ecstatic form, right? Some sort of an ecstatic form. Now, Ramak takes this already from a well-known belief within Jewish mystical circles that if you purify yourself to a certain degree and you allow the Shekhinah to come and speak through you, it will guide your hand and you will write not your own wisdom here, but the explications of either the Shekhinah or what can be another possibility known as transubstantiation, the spirit of a previous sage who is now embodied in you and speaks through you. Channeling is one way of putting it. Magid is another term. Magid is another term. You heard the term Magid. What does it mean, Magid? In the mystical sense, Magid means some sort of an oration that comes from a transubstantiated spirit within you. Maran Yosef Karo, who is well known for his Shulchan Aruch, is less known, unfortunately, for another book that he had written, which is an incredible book called Magid Meisharim, into which it is a collection of wisdoms that allegedly Maran Yosef Karo would omit by the voice of the Shekhinah, and there are some disciples like Chaim Vital and others who would actually swear that he spoke with the voice of a woman when it used to happen to him. Okay? Now, these people also believe, for example, that the book of the Zohar, right? You believe it. Who wrote it? Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, as some people claim, or Rabbi Moses de Leon, as some other people claim. Some mystics found a wonderful reconciliation between the two. It was written by Rabbi Moses de Leon, but he was guided by the spirit of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. So he was the scribe, but he was not the author. Okay? Now, in this sense, you have to be sensitive to the verses or the way that Cordovero is speaking about this. Because he's using the term Chizkat Hayad because it comes from prophetic literature. He talks, Akol miyad Adonai alai hiskil. The hand of God was bestowed upon me. It's from a prophetic literature. In other words, the ability to cleanse yourself to such a level that now you are literally opening up and you're being taken or overtaken by a Holy Spirit that now guides your writing. And I would not be surprised at all, if we're talking about the phenomenology of the mystical experience here, if Ramak awakened at a certain point and started reading what he had written because he had no clue at that point. In other words, there are enough examples to suggest some sort of an ecstatic mode where there was no connection between the writer and the message itself. He was merely a vehicle for a higher form of truth. But the higher form of truth was contingent upon the mystic's ability to purify himself to such a degree to allow this kind of entrance. So here again, a symbiotic relationship between the human and the divine. If you open yourself up, it will happen to you.
Was he going out on a limb by suggesting that it's happening?
Was he? First of all, you have to understand that when these texts were written, they were not for public use. These texts were written for a small cohort of mystics, of scholars, who understood what they're talking about. It was not open to scholars the way it's open today. It was not critically examined the way it's examined today. And again, in so many words, these people truly believed. In a dramatic sense, you don't even get the tip of it. They truly believed that they are a generation that corresponds directly with the giants of the Mishnah. And there are many forms of transubstantiations. Even between Ramak and Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, he doesn't say it in so many words, but there are enough, once you bring all the texts together and you start drawing conclusions out of them, they truly believed that they were in very intimate cohort with those sages, and that it was upon them to bring the nation of Israel to a redemptive catharsis. Ramak believed that the Messiah would arrive while he was still alive. They truly believed in that. And they believed, Ramak believed that he had attained prophecy in the most radical sense of the word.
Yes,
look, you know, you're touching a very, very interesting point. So it's not an ignorant shelat. You always find, especially in those close circles of people who were truly incredible scholars. I mean, these people were scholars to a degree that it's mind-boggling. I mean, it would take me sometimes to take one excerpt of Ramak, and it would take me a week to annotate it, because every second word of his was from a different source. And you bring them together with a new message, but you need now to debrief this and break it to pieces, and it will take you a week, because this word leads to this book, and he brings it with this book, and then he ties. So these were people on a different level, even on an intellectual level. On the one hand, they would come and say, the true tzaddik would never render himself such. Humility is the word of the day. In other words, you would try to shy away from any claims to grandeur. But then again, there is always a second level. That's the beauty of it. There is the level for the commoners. There is the level for the people, humble, you never claim. But within those slow circles, who truly believed that they are ushering in the Messianic era. They truly believe. I want you to understand that we're talking about a sense of urgency here, whose drama cannot be overstated. They truly believed that if they purify themselves and usher in the Shekhinah and run into dialogues with one another through the arbitration of the Shekhinah, they would reveal wisdoms that will eventually allow the Torah to unpack and blossom like a flower, and by doing so, bringing the Messianic era to earth. So they truly believed in their close circles that they are above everyone else. First of all, I don't know, because I never studied Chabad in depth. But look, for me, anybody who assumes the role of a prophet or assumes the role of a tzaddik or doesn't or accepts that designation from others has already claimed, in my opinion, to be the opposite. In other words, just like the Torah's beauty is in its ambiguity, the greatness of men, I mean men and women, lies in their humility. No, first of all, Ramak was never claimed to be, nor claimed to be a messianic figure. That's a completely different thing. But in those close circles, oh yeah, in close circles, these people were on cahoots with divinity on a daily basis. Again, it's very. We can run a whole course about the drama that is known as 16th century Tzfat for nearly 50 years. That's it. There's a drama there without which one cannot understand Judaism today. There's an inverse. By all means, but you have to understand what the reason I'm giving you this example, because I want you to see that there were people. There was this statement of the rabbis about prophecy. They understood prophecy on different levels. And they did not necessarily agree in deeper circles that prophecy has ceased from Israel. Quite the contrary. Quite the contrary. They relied on prophetic knowledge to lead the people towards redemption. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. They believed that they had mandate from divinity to lead a nation towards redemption. A cosmic redemption. Not just redemption of Tzfat. Cosmic redemption. It was for them. For them, it was their daily bread. That's what they lived. And again, it's very hard, unless you really study this in depth, to understand the drama of urgency that had taken place in those days. I mean, those people would sleep 3 hours, in a full day. And after 3 hours, there are texts that say that somebody would knock on their door, "You lazy pigs. How dare you sleep when the Shekhinah is calling for you, yearning for you? How can you..." By the way, it's not surprising that so many of them died so young. I mean, the level of intensity that those people lived by, you can hardly imagine how they lived for so long. I mean, really, Maran Yosef Karo is truly an exception. I mean, he lived to 85 or something like that. Others died at 30, 32, 40, 45.
How did they live? How were they supported?
Oh, the community. Kollelin, my community, Italian Jewry, big one, Venice, Damascus, Salonika, many, many, many areas. By the way, they had profound arguments with Jerusalem at the time, because they actually believed that they are the center of the Catholic, but that's a whole different story. Now, guys, let us move to the PowerPoint presentation. Tell me, can you see the details? Because if you want, you can come a little bit closer. Actually, you know what? Should we turn the lights off? Because okay, let's. Where do you turn the lights off? Maybe even turn this one off and turn. Okay, can you see? Oh, great. Okay, artists' views of divine illumination. Here I will give you some sort of an assortment of a lot of the things that we talked about today. And you'll see how they were rendered in all sorts of religious art. And here is a 16th century painting that shows a beautiful image, in this case of Adam, who sits on top of some sort of a stage, but look what is happening to him. An angel is blowing, right? He's blowing a horn between his eyes. It's a source of divine illumination that will henceforth render him the first human who understands what God wants from him. This is, of course, before his so-called fall. Moses, the master of all prophets, look at the agonizing face. Not surprisingly. And here are a few depictions of Moses as they appear in art. Look at the beauty of the prophet who stands and is being illuminated before he's prepared to receive the divine word. One thing that is conspicuously missing from this painting, you will see in a minute as something that is rendered almost necessary in each and every one of them. Guido Reni, 16th century. Look at the light that affects his temple as he received this illumination. Remember that they have in mind the biblical phrase that says that his face, Vikaran Or Panav. This is a modern Israeli artist who just renders his face gold lit. But here now come a few depictions that show us the classical understanding of Moses. Here is Moses presenting the tablets to the people of Israel. And can you see how they are responding? Everybody averts their eyes from him. Moses is surrounded by a halo of light. And those of you who have sharp eyes can see that there are already two beams of light stretching from his head. You see them? In a minute you'll see that there are ones that are much more conspicuous. Again, Gustav Dore, the famous... Is there anyone here who has not seen the Bible with the lithographs of Gustav Dore, I highly recommend that you watch it. It's a classic of biblical art, Gustav Dore, the German. Here are two other depictions. The left one, not surprisingly, is from Ethiopia. You can see Moses' face, but the rendition is the same one. The beams of light stretching from his forehead. Here is one that is quite beautiful because the Ten Commandments here appear in Greek. Here's another one. This is Rembrandt, who was fascinated by the Jewish community in Amsterdam. Rembrandt also was fascinated by divine illumination and divine guidance, and we'll see some other works by him. He, of course, takes the time to write the commandments in Hebrew, and look at the play of light and dark. You can see the two, now those horns, they are not exactly beams of light anymore. They have more of a substantial appearance to them. Here is one from the 14th century Germany, and here Moses appears with two elements that already appear like horns. Of course, as was in medieval Europe, the people and the rendition of the cultural rendition of the whole episode is, of course, highly European. This is a great depiction, 14th century Germany. I've never seen Ten Commandments who are so elaborate. Look at that. That comes out with explanations, Talmud, everything there. Moses sits there, and, of course, two small horns coming from his forehead. Behind him is Mount Sinai still being illuminated at the top. If you can see the smoke and everything, the famous Michelangelo's Moses. And now let's move to other prophets. This is Chagall's windows. This is called Isaiah's calling. And tell me what you see or what you think you see. Isaiah is the one at the bottom. Who is on top of him?
An angel.
You can see, right? And what does the angel do? No, quite the contrary. What does he do? Yes, he touches his lips in order to render them pure for the prophetic message. Here is another depiction of Isaiah being touched by an angel. And you can see that the angel touches him with some sort of either a beacon or a lit torch. Isaiah, by the way, on the right top drawing, is already engaged in what we shall later see, guided or automatic or ecstatic writing. His face is completely transfixed at the angel. His mind, his hand, on the other hand, is busy writing. Is this idea of a scribe who is not the author. Here is Raphael doing the same thing with Isaiah. I'm sorry about the resolution of this photo. It's not very clear. That's the way it was in the original. But look at Raphael. This is part of Raphael's depiction of all the prophets. Look at Isaiah engaged in guided writing. His face, he's completely meditating over something that he's hearing. He's not looking at the paper. His hand is writing independently, and he's in some sort of an ecstatic mode. Here is another one by Gustav Dore that shows Jeremiah's ecstatic speech. Here Jeremiah is in such ecstasy that he's not even able to write, so somebody is literally writing for him. But look at the channel of edification that is being given here. Fascinating depiction by Gustav Dore. What is happening to Jeremiah? He's encompassed by this beam of light, right? This illumination, and then
he's transmitting the information.
Precisely. His hand is now touching the head of the scribe, who is now rendering that speech into some sort of a written form. This is a fascinating depiction of the prophet Ezekiel. I gave for you another paper here that you can look at later on. This is the beginning of the book of Ezekiel with one of the most famous, the vision of the chariots. So you can see Ezekiel having a vision of divinity. In this painting, a very, very kind of classical depiction of an old man sitting on a throne on high, because it's loyal to some degree to what Ezekiel is depicting. And what is below, what is between Ezekiel and God? A number of things. What do you see? You can see a hand giving him what? Some kind of a scroll. Do you remember what happens to Ezekiel? Ezekiel is being fed. He's being fed a scroll. Vatehi befi kidvash lematok, he says. And it was as sweet as honey in my mouth. He's literally consuming the knowledge. He's literally consuming this type of knowledge. This will have a major effect later on the idea of consuming also a body of knowledge by some Christian rituals. What else do we see? What is below there beaming with light? Two elements. On the right side, the wheel, the fantastic depiction of this ambiguous thing, right? That four wheels and that. And on the left, this angelic being that is very complex, very hard to depict. What we do know about this angelic being is, among other things, that it had four faces of. One is a lion, one is a human, an angel. One is an eagle, and one
an ox
or a bull, right? Four faces. Remember that. It will have a major impact on early Christianity. Here is a Muslim depiction. And let's see if you can tell me, looking to the left, who are we looking at from left to right? Who is the person to the left? Who do you think it is? It is Moses, whose head is on fire, as to suggest the divine illumination. He's not burning. Between them, the major figure, the major angelic figure in Islam, who is Gabriel, known in Arabic as Jibril. And to the right, who do you think? Who can it be? Muhammad, whose face is also illuminated, but with one major difference. Muhammad now has the veil over his face. What used to be Moses' property is now rendered to Muhammad, who is now the seal of all prophets, the greatest prophets, prophet for Islam. And now you can see on the right side another depiction of Muhammad being edified by Jibril. You cannot see his face because his face is illuminating to such a degree that no mortal can depict it. I have already discussed the Jewish origins of that depiction. Now here is a Christian depiction of the Pentecost. Anybody knows what the what's the Pentecost? Nachon. And what happens in certain Christian circles at that time? Through? This is the question of pious people who are now able to propagate the divine wisdom or Jesus' wisdom by being able to speak to people in their own tongues. Now look at this depiction. Here is an example of a male disciple to the right and a female disciple to the left. What do you see above their heads? Rays coming down from heaven, illuminating. You see there's like a flame coming from their head. They're being illuminated with the divine word, and now they're able to speak in tongues. I won't go into the historical reasons behind this ability to speak in tongues. Christianity is very different from Judaism as its predecessor and Islam as its successor by not having what is known in Judaism and Islam a divine vernacular, in Judaism Hebrew, in Islam Arabic. Christians, there is no such thing as a divine vernacular, but rather there is a divine message that can be translated into every language. Now we're moving on here, just on a lighter note. We're tired of being taught of as little fat naked babies with bows and arrows. Angelic figures had a much more serious role in that context. And here is William Blake, a modern artist, who now speaks about the angel of Revelation as a huge figure with one hand in the heavens. And what is in his left hand? Can anyone see? Actually, it's a book. He's holding a book in his hand. Now, a lot of people who are enjoying this, and between his legs, what do you see? Between his legs, there is a man on a horse. And here, below, what do you see?
Scribe.
Yes, there is a woman who is engaged in automatic writing. You see her head is to one direction, her hand is completely to another. Here is Michelangelo depicting the prophet Daniel, supported by an angelic figure, right?
Yeah. Yes.
And look at his hand, look at his right hand. What is he doing?
He's writing.
He's in a complete ecstatic mode. Here is another depiction of the prophet Daniel, supported by a celestial angel, listening to a voice that comes from somewhere. His hand is already holding some sort of a pen, ready to write, but very, very attentive to a voice that comes from somewhere. It's not from a particular point. Here is a depiction of Saint Matthew and Saint John. What do you see here that connects you already to the prophet Ezekiel? First of all, who are Saint Matthew and Saint John? Two out of four apostles. Right? Four apostles. We have Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Who supports Matthew? An angel. You can see his wings. In a fascinating depiction, the angel seems to be aware of the painter, but Matthew is in a completely ecstatic mode. He's not even aware of the angel. And St. John, who is busy writing, and his book is supported by?
What is this? Can you see? It's an eagle. It's a bird. It's an eagle. What does it remind you? Ezekiel, angelic being, this divine throne, is now divided into four parts in early Christianity. St. Matthew is that part of the angelic part of that divine throne. St. John is the eagle. Luke will be the bull, and Mark will be the lion. And we'll see all the depictions as we progress. Here is St. Matthew and St. Jerome. Who is St. Matthew in your opinion? The one, actually, that's St. Jerome. How do we know that St. Matthew is to the right? Because his book is supported by an angel. You see, just like we saw before. He's supporting the book. Now, the Annunciation of St. Mary. Again, the same idea. Here is an angel. Who is the angel, by the way? I just mentioned it to you. Gabriel. This is why he has such a central role in Islam, because he has a central role also in Christianity. Gabriel is giving the Annunciation. And what is the dove above her head?
Actually, that's the Holy Ghost. The image of the Holy Ghost is a white dove. Whenever you see depictions of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost or the Holy Spirit, it is always a white dove. Is Mary looking at any of them?
No.
Is Mary looking at the angel who seems to be talking to her as she looks at the writings on the left side? No. They're there, but they're in spirit. She's aware of them. She's not communicating with them on a tangible form. Here is a wonderful depiction of St. Luke painting the Holy Mother and Son. On this version, he's doing it on his own. I'm always saddened by this photo, by this picture, because Joseph, Mary's husband, is in the corner looking, and he's not allowed into the hall because he's not part of the Holy Family anymore. You see him over there? He's shunned. But here, Luke seems to have a direct vision of the Mother and the Son, and he's painting them. Here, the same concept of Luke painting Mary and Jesus, but now he's enjoying some sort of an angelic aspiration. There is an angel standing next to him and aspiring him to have this vision. The third version, look what happens. Here's another one of St. Luke, but look what happens now. Mary and Jesus appear as a vision. You see the cloud. And what is the angel doing? He's literally holding Luke's hand. You see? You see it, guys? You see it? He's holding Luke's hand. Luke is now painting from some sort of an ecstatic mode, being held, his hand being held by a celestial guy. Here is St. Paul, Shaul HaTarsi, the apostle. I don't remember who did this. This is Guido, or I don't remember. What do you see here that suggests some sort of a prophetic moment?
Kind of in a trance state.
He seems to be in a trance state. What is he? Can you see what he's holding?
From his left hand.
Yes, there is a pen. There is light seem to beam on him from the right and from the left. And it's hard to depict, my friends, but in his right hand he's holding a pen.
Yeah.
You see it?
Yeah.
He's in some sort of an ecstatic mode before starting to write. Here is St. Basil the Great from the 4th century. The 4th century being a very important century in Christianity. That's when Christianity becomes much more dogmatic and becomes also accepted eventually by Constantinople, Constantinus I, as the Holy Church of the Roman Empire, the East Roman Empire. And here he is. He's having a vision, and he's holding a pen in his right hand. He's ready to write. Here is St. Gregory from the 4th century, busy writing, but there is a hand, a divine hand from the upper right side, you see, coming from a cloud, guiding him. This is a fantastic depiction of St. Jerome from the 15th century. Here is already a depiction of, here you can see the negotiation, the subtle negotiation between theology and philosophy. Theology comes with a crucifix on the bottom. You can see the crucifix with Jesus on the floor, and the philosopher's skull on the right hand, rendering Jerome not only a theologian but a scholar who is transfixed to some sort of a knowledge and busy in automatic or guided writing. Three depictions of Guercino, 16th century Italy. Of St. Jerome inspired or inspiring an angel. Look to the right, he's transfixed at the crucifix and writing with his right hand. In the middle, he's engaged in a conversation with an angel. And to the left, again, very similar to the one on the right, he's inspired by an angel, and also as part of this depiction, inspired by one of the writers of the Gospel. Who do you think it is? By Mark. How do we know? There is a lion at the bottom left of the photo of the painting. You see it?
Yeah.
Here is St. Jerome's vision. Again, the image comes again and again. The handwriting and the mind is transfixed somewhere else. Here's the horn of Revelation. And to the right, again, an angel that comes and speaks. Look at the very beautiful and subtle game play of light and darkness to suggest this form of illumination. Here is Saint Augustine, 4th century and 5th century, having a vision of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. You can see them in the middle. And he's busy writing with his right hand. Another depiction of the same vision. Here's another depiction of the same vision. The Trinity is in the middle there in a bubble. You can see it. Mm-hmm. And he's busy writing. Here is St. Augustine's vision of the Holy Trinity. And for those of you who wanted to see the depiction of the Holy Trinity, you can see the Father to the right, Jesus to the left, the Son, and a dove, an illuminated dove between their two heads. You see it over there?
Yeah.
The Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. St. Jerome is in ecstatic mode. And he's some sort of engaging in a discussion with the angels as to what he's hearing. It's a fantastic photo of St. Augustine's vision of the truth. He's holding in his left hand the apple of knowledge from the Garden of Eden, who's being burnt by the fire of Veritas to the left. And look at the fire of illumination stemming from his skull as he's busy getting ready to write with his right hand. A fantastic depiction of St. Augustine and St. John the Baptist and St. Peter, of course not from the same time. They're all engaged in some sort of a dialogue that transcends time and space, pointing to an angel that gives them knowledge and sheds light on them. Here's a fantastic one from the early medieval period, St. Thomas Aquinas, who will become a major voice in medieval Christianity. He's being informed by no other than the Holy Ghost. He doesn't look at the ghost. He feels its presence, and his quilt is being illuminated by its presence, and he's now writing automatically. Here is another depiction of the same thing. The dove literally whispers in his ear. He hears a voice. He doesn't see an image, and he's busy writing. Here's again St. Augustine writing, an angel helping him, the divine light coming from above. Here he is literally talking to Jesus before going to continue writing his works. The doctors of the church, all of them busy in some sort of automatic writing. Look at the figure to the left, look at the figure to the right, and Jesus on top. And now, mamash images of guided writing. As you can see now, a depiction of the four creatures who are now separated from the vision of Ezekiel into four separate creatures, who each one is now in charge of one of the writers of the Gospels in Christianity. Here are the four. First of all, here's a rendition that shows you exactly how they are divided. We have Matthew to the upper left, governed by an angel. We have Luke to the bottom right, guided by a bull. We have John guided by an eagle. John to the upper right, guided by an eagle. And we have Mark to the left bottom, guided by a winged lion. Here they are, another one, the four by Rubens, a famous Renaissance painter. And you can see all the animals hovering between them. You have a lion, you have an ox, you have an angel, even pointing to what Matthew should write. And you have the bull. You can see the horns to the far, in the middle left corner there. Here again, the same. You can see the animals. This is a beautiful depiction of the bull. Look to the left in the right painting, informing Luke what to write. St. John, where's the eagle? No, that's an angel. The eagle is at the bottom right, next to the trunk of the tree, guiding him, protecting him. You can see? He's being guided by an eagle, by an angel, and protected by an eagle. It was a fantastic photo. Took me a while to take this photo because I actually took it from an exhibition at the in Chicago, and raised the fury of the curator. But eventually, I told them what I'm doing it for, so they allowed me to take all the other photos as well. But you can see the remnant of the flash of my camera there. Okay, St. John engaged in automatic writing, and the eagle protects him. Here are a few other depictions of St. John doing the same thing. Here the eagle is winged and look kind of half angelic, and look at St. John, kind of. This photo, those of you who know a little bit about Christian art will immediately recognize the photo to the left as coming from the eastern provinces of either Ukraine or Turkey or Russia. This is not Roman Catholic. Yeah, exactly. Here are other depictions of St. John The one to the right depicts St. John listening and receiving the quilt with which he's going to write, also overcoming the temptation of the snake from Eden, who is coming out, popping out of a cup, a broken cup to his right. You see it? This one I like because it renders the eagle doing a very mundane activity, like cleaning its wings, while St. John is busy in guided writing. The two more depictions, you can recognize them and understand their context. Here again, the eagle to the right. Here is the eagle kind of getting ready to protect St. John from the temptations of Lucifer. To the left, St. Luke, his book supported by a bull or an ox. Here's a huge, again, from a Greek Orthodox church. And look at the tiny, tiny bull protecting the ink. Well, looking up, making sure that St. Luke is protected. St. Luke, of course, is looking somewhere that is not exactly identified. Here again, enjoying the hand of divinity. And you can see Lucaccio to the right. Now you can see, without me talking too much, you can see the process. This is fantastic, a stark look by an almost human-looking lion that protects St. Mark. Here is St. Mark being edified by the lion from above. This is a very interesting image because it comes from a Greek Orthodox church, and it has taken a while until some scholars realized that the two things that we're looking at are not the only two things. They realized that there is a faint trace of Jesus in this photo. And they recognize it right here. You can see a face there?
Yeah.
It's most likely true because he's not looking at Jesus, he's just being edified by him, which seems to subscribe to the motif as we've seen it so far. But again, the same depictions. Look at him, he's looking somewhere, the lion is behind him, but he's looking somewhere and busy writing. St. Matthew and the angel. This is fantastic because this is one of the only ones that actually shows a prophet or someone who is actually aware of the angelic presence. He's actually consulting with the angel. This is by Guido Reni, 16th century. In other depictions, one by Rembrandt, you'll see that he's completely unaware. Absolutely, completely. Here he is. He's looking to the heavens, but he's hearing a voice. Here, fantastic depiction. The angel is next to him. Look at this angel. He's a baby holding the ink pen. Holding the ink in his head. The prophet is not even recognizing him there, the evangelist. Here the angel talks to him, even touches him, but he's not looking at him. He's aware of the presence, but not corresponding with it. Here the angel is holding a divine book, whereas St. Matthew is writing his gospel based on that illumination. This is a fantastic by Savoldo. Look at the look on his face. He's completely ecstatic. He's not looking at the prophet. He's not looking at the angel. This one really depicts his kind of a meditational stature. He's hearing something, and he's completely unaware of what he's writing. It's absolutely fantastic. This one to the right, can anybody guess to what church it belongs? To what Christian stream it belongs? This is St. Matthew according to the Mormon Church. And if you look at the angel, you'll see that he's actually dressed as a pilgrim at the early 18th, 19th centuries. I mean, he has a look about him that is very, very modern, almost semi, kind of depicting the heroic figure of the Mormon Church. This is a fantastic depiction of St. Matthew being guided by an angel who supports what he's written so far. Here again, writing, the angel supporting, but St. Matthew is not aware of his presence. Here is an angel enumerating a few precepts for St. Matthew to write. He's again guiding him. This one is fantastic, the one to the right. It's hard to see, but St. Matthew here is sitting down. He has a keren shefar, a horn that now receives a voice that is being poured by an angel from above, a tiny figure that pours the line of illumination into his left hand, and in his right hand, he is now depicting whatever it is he's sensing. This is fantastic, a fantastic, fantastic depiction of Saint Matthew, and here literally, look at the way the hand of the angel and how symbiotic they are, and he's literally holding his hand, mamash intertwined. It's fantastic, intimate moment. It's a fantastic photo. I mean, a fantastic painting, and he's literally holding his hand, but he's not mamash guiding it, but he's supporting it, giving it the divine endorsement that it needs in order to write. This is by Rembrandt. Anybody who knows Rembrandt knows that he used to depict himself most of the times. And we know for a fact that both the older Matthew and the angel who is whispering in his hand are both renditions of Rembrandt at different stages in life. This is young Rembrandt and this is older Rembrandt depicting Saint Matthew. Look at him probing at what he's hearing. And the angel is literally whispering at his ear with his hand on his shoulder, a very intimate, tender moment. But St. Matthew is not seeing anything. He's just hearing. To end with the lighter side, much, much lighter side, let us see from the far side. Here is just to make things interesting, God says, and pepper some jerks into the universe. You can see they're holding... Here is God at his computer, about to push the button that is called smite. Here is the conversation between Pharaoh that says no way and Moses that says Yahweh. Putting theology in a different context. I talked to you about the beauty of Torah being ambiguous. It's good, I like it, Moses says, but I know these people, they're going to want specifics. And here's another rendition. The Ten Commandments, thou shalt not kill, men's amendments, except assisted suicide, capital punishment, etc. Interfaith relations. This is Moses playing a prank on Jesus. And here's another one. Moses, stop it. I like this one. Here is a prophet who comes to the psychiatrist and says, I have difficulties expressing my feelings. And this is about the Gospels. Blessed are the Christians, for they will be crucified, fed to the lions, suffer crusaders and schisms, and end up bombing each other. And now one of the Gospels says to the other, tell you what, Mark, when we write the Gospels, better edit out that bit. And with this, my friends, we end our session. Since I'm... Can you turn on the light?
Yeah.
Since I'm no prophet, I'll just say that it's been a pleasure and that I truly hope, I don't know, but I truly hope that we'll see each other again and have the privilege.